including Taj Mahal, Rory Block, Sergio and Odier Assad, Daniel Lanois, Cindy Cashdollar, Bill Frisell, Juan Martin, and Vernon Reed. For more information about Wall to Wall Guitar, September 29th through October 2nd, visit KreinertCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about education and education reform and concentrating, I'm sure, for at least a good part of our talk this morning on that legislation known as No Child Left Behind, something that was made a priority by the Bush administration. In fact, even Candidate Bush said that education reform was something that would be very important to him. The act has now been in effect for a couple of years, and it seems that while there are some positives you can point to, that the results have been a little bit mixed. We'll be talking about that this morning and other things, I'm sure, with our guest, Patty Sullivan, from the Center on Education Policy in Washington, D.C. Before going to work at the center, where she is center director, she served as the deputy director for advocacy and strategic planning at the Council for Chief State School Officers. Before that, she served a number of roles at the senior education staff person at the National Governors Association. And then also before that, she served on the House Subcommittee on Post-Secondary Education. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief with their comments, and we ask that so that we can accommodate as many different folks as possible and keep things moving along. But, of course, anybody who is interested in being involved in the conversation, make a comment, ask a question, that is certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. And, of course, even people who might be listening on the Internet may also use it as long as you're in the United States. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you want to be involved in the conversation, you can give us a call. Ms. Sullivan, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm pleased to join you.
We certainly appreciate it. Well, I do, at least to here to begin, want to talk a little bit about No Child Left Behind, because I know your organization a couple of months ago put out a survey, a report looking at how we were doing. And in fact, I think year by year you've had a report looking at the results of No Child Left Behind.
That's correct.
And I know that, as I said, I think the president, even when he was running the first time around, said that education reform was important to him. And I would expect that if you asked him to list the achievements of his presidency, that No Child Left Behind would be one of them that he would point to as having been a success. Also, though, if you look out across the country, there are some places where some school districts have concerns about it. There are states that said they've actually wanted to opt out. There are other places where they say that they simply don't have the resources to try to carry out the mandate. So it seems that the picture has been a little bit mixed. Maybe to start, having said all that, we should just remind people about what the basic idea is of No Child Left Behind.
Well, the basic premise of the No Child Left Behind Act is to shift the focus of schools and school districts on something that we haven't done before, and that is to focus on not the entire school or the entire school district's performance, but instead to have us looking more closely at how individual groups of students perform. And so, for example, we want to look more carefully at how African-American students or Latina students or students with special needs, special education students perform in schools. And that's been a real shift, and No Child Left Behind has taken us to looking at subgroups of students in ways that we haven't before.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very important underlying premise. The other important underlying premise that relates to that is that we want to make sure that all of those students are challenged and assessed as appropriate. And so under the old system, I think folks within the Bush administration would argue that some of these kids were left behind, and their performance was sort of masked or hidden by the performance of other students in the school who were doing better. And so the combination of saying no child left behind, but also looking at the performance of individual groups of students has really changed the way schools do business. And if you look at our reports, I mean, we do probably the most comprehensive analysis of the implementation of the Act. We just produced year three in March. We hear from educators, both through our sample of national sample of school districts and schools and through our survey of states, that very much educators are taking this mandate and using the data that's produced by it and changing the way schools operate.
I think that probably for as long as I can remember, at least the last 20, 30 years, and when people talked about education reform, one of the big buzzwords was accountability. People were saying, we want to see that students are performing well and that their performance is improving over time, and we want to see that documented in a very real, clear sort of way. And to that end, one of the things that this legislation did is to say, for the federal government to say to the states, we expect there to be standards set, and we expect you to work towards meeting those standards so that you can very clearly show us that your students are doing well. If you look at that, can you use that as a measure and say, in fact, yes, the student improvement has – student achievement has improved, and we have some numbers here we can show you?
Well, first of all, you have to step back and remember that a long time before No Child Left Behind came into existence, most states had standards and assessment into place. This is a federal reform that's being layered on top of existing state systems. And so a lot of those premises were there. The data that we have, and we see it both within the reporting that we get from states and districts and also from the performance of students on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, that's the national test that we have, show that student achievement, for the most part, not across all grades, but for the most part, is going up. What we don't know is, are kids learning more? We do know that they're doing better on tests, but we don't indeed know if they're actually learning more, understanding better, would be able to perform at a higher level, only because after any major reform is put into place, there tends to be a bump up in performance. There also, it's like anything else that you measure, people tend to pay more attention to it. And we're seeing, for example, a narrowing of the curriculum across schools. So indeed, if you're spending more time on reading and math, you would expect the kids to do better in reading and math because you're not doing other things, you're focused on those two subjects. So the jury is out a little bit, and we're trying to understand here whether or not kids really know more, even though we do know that test scores are going up.
Hmm. I think another thing that, and you may have to clear me up on this notion, that this does is that establishes a direct relationship between documented student performance and the kind of support that the schools receive. And in a sense, they're saying if your students meet these standards, then you'll get the support, but if they don't, you won't. Is it really as clear-cut as that?
It is not clear-cut as that. The No Child Left Behind Act, as in addition to most state accountability systems that were there, and what's confusing about this for parents, I see it in my own community all the time, is that you've got the state system of accountability, which you have in Illinois, and then you have No Child Left Behind. They're two systems, and they sort of bump up against each other, and they differ in every state. So. But the No Child Left Behind Act provides funding for primarily students of high poverty, focused under what's referred to as the Title I program. And if within those schools that receive Title I money, there are a series of consequences that happen if the students don't continue to improve based on the benchmarks that are set under the law. But in no circumstances does the money get pulled away if you don't do well. If anything, what the law promises is additional support. Now, the problem is there isn't the federal funding behind the promise to make sure that that support happens. And indeed, if you look at the data, 80% of school districts tell us, including Chicago, that they're spending their own money to implement the law.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a sort of rising set of sanctions, consequences for schools about what they have to do, without the extra support to help them do those new set of activities.
Let me ask you one other question, then we have a couple callers. I want to make sure those people know I'm not going to make them wait forever. But I want about some of the kinds of stories that we have heard about districts in various places in order to meet the standards that for student performance that have been set. They have actually taken some of the students that have maybe have special needs, have difficulties, are not performing well, and simply stopped counting them, taking them out of the mix, making student performance look better by taking the students whose performance is poorest and simply taking it out of the mix. Just how common is that?
It's not very common at all, because there's another rule under No Child Left Behind that says that if you have to test 95% of your students, and if 95% of the students don't take the test, then you automatically don't meet the benchmark. So even if you test, 94 and all of them get 100%, you still don't make the grade, because the concern on the part of the federal government is that all kids be part of the accountability system. Now, there are some special rules, obviously, for kids who don't speak English, for example, or children who have special needs, special education children who can be exempted. But for the most part, you've got to test every kid, or almost every kid, and that's counter to what used to happen, where on testing day, people would say that educators would say to the dumb kids, oh, please stay home. That's not happening under the statute. And for the most part, was not happening before, but there was sort of a mythology around that indeed is not happening now.
We have a couple of callers here, and we'll start to bring people in the conversation, and perhaps I should also reintroduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Patty Sullivan. She is the director at the Center on Education Policy, that's in Washington, D.C., and has been involved in the area of education policy for quite a long time. Before going to work at the center, she was at the had a position at the Council for Chief State School Officers. She was Deputy Director for Advocacy and Strategic Planning. And then going back before that, she served on the House Subcommittee on Post-Secondary Education as a staff person. Questions or comments are welcome here. We're talking about education reform. Particularly, we've been talking about this legislation known as No Child Left Behind. It's been going now for a couple of years. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have several callers. In fact, the lines are full. We'll start in here with someone listening up in Aurora, not far from Chicago. Line number four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. This is a subject dear to my heart, and I watch it more now because my daughter has been teaching behavior. She taught behavior-disturbed children for 3 years, and now she is teaching children with difficulty learning difficulties. And this spring, when the classes ended, when school closed, one of the students brought her a bouquet of roses and told her that she was the best teacher he ever had. And then when she told me the story, I said, how wonderful. And she says to me, but Mom, I don't know if he'll live to be 21. So I think we have to realize, and like you just said, these children are exempted from the testing, these type of children. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm sorry. The certain children who have special needs, and it sounds like your daughter knows much more about this as someone in the classroom every day than I do, but children who have special needs have the benefit of another federal law to help them under what's called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA.
And IDEA?
Yes. And that law provides guidance and permits a group of people within that school district where the student is enrolled to come up with an education plan for how that student should work. And your daughter would have been involved in the planning of that, or the development of that plan. It sounds like she did a terrific job of executing it, if the student was that appreciative. But most likely, if a student has a severe learning disability and is unable to take the test, they're most likely not going to participate in the big state assessment. But they are going to take the sort of daily tests that our kids take that help teachers understand and help your daughter understand what she needs to do to help that child learn either more about math or fractions or wherever that child is struggling. So the day-to-day assessments they'll still take, it's just the big state assessment that they're probably exempted from.
The other thing that's a big problem is her classroom. Her classroom, I would say, is 8 maybe by 10 feet, maybe. No windows. She has to open a door to the library to get air into the room because they have so many children coming into that district. And that, when I went to the classroom, I was just horrified. I couldn't believe that that was a classroom. Thank God the referendum went through and they will be building school, more room for the children. But that's another situation that enters into this learning situation, that the census, that the children sometimes overwhelm a community that come in, overwhelm the community. They cannot provide for them.
Well, and it sounds like, I've seen this, it sounds like it may be the case here. If a school has a very good program and has some very good instructors, parents hear about that. And so I watch it all the time where different communities develop concentrations of, you know, for example, autistic children. There's a particular good program at a particularly good school with a particularly good teacher. Parents will flock to that community. And it takes a little time for the system to catch up with new numbers. But it sounds like you're fortunate in your community that the referendum passed. In many communities, they don't. So to the extent that you're getting a new facility, congratulations. That's terrific.
Well, I don't think that they're flocking to the school. I think they're crossing the border, to put it honestly. Well, thank you for your program. I will listen intently.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll continue. And we have some local people here. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. My understanding is that the No Child Left Behind Act was supposed to help prevent kids from falling through the cracks. I was talking with a Champaign school board member who said that in Illinois there are no standards at all for children who are homeschooled. And in fact, there are a lot of people doing a good job with homeschooling their kids, but apparently, for instance, if there is a kid who's having a truancy problem, all the parent has to do is say, I'm going to homeschool him. And or her, and the school and the state drop any responsibility for checking to see if that child is actually getting adequate schooling. And it seems to me that this No Child Left Behind Act seems to me the state and the federal government are leaving these kids dangling in the wind. And I'm also wondering, I think this is just applying to public schools as well. Are there any standards for private schools?
But you are correct in that the No Child Left Behind Act does not apply to home school students and to private school students. And indeed, historically, the language in the federal education statutes, which have been on the books since about 1965, have expressly prohibited the federal government from regulating in those areas. However, there are instances in different states. Illinois is not one of them. But there are circumstances where homeschooled students are required to participate not in the annual assessments that are given under No Child Left Behind, but they're required to participate in the high school exit exams for graduation purposes. And in some cases, they're not required to participate in the graduation tests that are given in 26 states now, just for the diploma purposes. But, for example, in the state of Nevada, if you want the state scholarship, the two-year scholarship for the first 2 years of college, you have to have a Nevada diploma. So private school students and homeschooled students take the test very frequently just because they want to have access to scholarship money. But for the most part, because education is so decentralized and is very much the role of state government, the federal government has not tried to intervene in this area. But with a growing number of students participating in homeschooling, it's still very small. It's less than 5%. Private school students are less than 7%. So it's a very small population of students. The federal government has just not intervened to regulate in that area.
Well, it seems to me that there's a possibility here for abuse. I think about the kinds of parents, and there are many parents who are really, you know, dedicated, but there are also some who really can't be bothered, even including getting their kids to school. And if they say, I'm going to homeschool my kid, there's no, the damage is done to the kid if the kid is not getting an education. And it's too late to deal with it by the time of high school and just say you have to pass an exam to get a high school diploma. There's just so much time lost. And I think, too, about the parents who are abusive. There's so much more going on here. I realize that, you know, you can't do everything, but it seems to me we're leaving out a major thing here, and we're assuming that parents, that all parents who say I can homeschool my kid are doing an adequate job. Thanks a bunch.
Okay. If we could just, we'll go on to some other callers here in just a second, but to talk a little bit more about federal government regulation, just to make this point clear, because it seems that some of those people, at least, who have raised objections about No Child Left Behind have said that something like, here's, it's another example of too much government regulations. And in fact, they would make that strong argument that regulating schools, deciding how you run your schools, is definitely a state and local issue, and that it's something that the federal government just doesn't need to be involved in. Did No Child Left Behind introduce a lot more in terms of government oversight, federal government oversight, than had been in existence before?
I think it's fair to say that No Child Left Behind did indeed do that. If you talk to state legislators and governor's offices and state education officials, they would refer to the law as being very intrusive, only because it's set into place a very specific set of sanctions that weren't there before and a very specific set of benchmarks. You know, historically, the Constitution is silent on the issue of the federal role in education, so that role automatically gets designated to the states. And the states have been very protective of that role. But I think it's fair to say that No Child Left Behind came about because of an impatience that was felt on the part of some governors, indeed, you know, Governor Bush, who felt it in Texas, representatives of the business community, and some education reformers who just felt that states and districts were not moving quickly along enough. That, you know, we'd had the Nation at Risk report, which sort of set a benchmark, you know, almost 20 years ago of where we needed to be, and we're not moving quickly enough to change our schools. So while it is viewed as being very intrusive, and if you look at the lawsuits that have been filed around No Child Left Behind, both by states now, two of them, and districts, and if you look at the grounds by which states have started to really push back on No Child Left Behind, and if you look at the district lawsuits, you very much pick up the sense that there's a feeling that this is not a federal role, and there's a resistance to the intrusion of the federal government in this area.
We have some other callers. We'll continue, and we'll go next to talk with somebody here on our line number two, and that's someone listening in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. You made a distinction before between doing better on the test and learning, and you also suggested that reading and math were being emphasized because of the test to the neglect of other subjects. I just want to state my view that I don't know what else is more important than reading and math. I mean, I can't imagine anything that goes on in a school that's more important than learning how to read. Because if you don't know how to read, you're gone. And if you teach to the test and you learn, and the test teaches you how to read, you read. I mean, I don't see any problem with that. So I don't understand what point you're making when you make that distinction.
Well, I make that distinction because there are a lot of people who assume that all tests are good, and that if you teach to a test that's not good, it's a good instructional experience for kids, which it's not. And I agree with you that you almost can't learn other subjects in school if you can't read and you can't do math. And quite frankly, now the way math is being taught, you've got to read to do math because there's so much reading embedded in the math curriculum, which is, again, a good thing because rarely in my day-to-day job do I just do straight computation. I'm constantly doing, you know, problems that I have to figure out the question for before I can attempt it. So those are good experiences for kids to have. But that's all based on the set of assumptions that it's a good test. And that the kind of curriculum and the kind of instruction that's being provided is truly instruction and not just teaching the kids to pass a test.
Well, what's your evaluation of the test then?
Well, it depends on the test. Every test that the state uses is different, and it's administered very differently. All 50 states have a different assessment system. So some states have a test that's more focused, that's richer in reading and math. For example, the state of Connecticut is in a major squabble with the U.S. Department of Education because they really want their students to learn how to write as part of their assessment system. So they have what are referred to as open-ended questions or questions with prompts so that the kids don't fill in bubbles. They actually have to think and write, which most educators say is a good experience for kids, and they learn more. So that's one set of testing experiences. There are other states that choose to have a test where truly it's just multiple choice. The test is not necessarily aligned to what they've been taught. I mean, the systems are not as sophisticated in all states.
I see.
And so you really, it drives people crazy when I say this, but you really have to go and look at the testing system.
Right.
And see if it's a really good test, and if it's a good test, my sense is go test to it.
Right.
But if it's a rote test where the child is just going to have to spit back information with no context and no real learning, that's a different question.
Right. But do you feel, as I do, that when you read about the goals of No Child Left Behind, that it's a great democratic and wonderful attempt to prevent kids, to bring up all kids equal, to teaching all kids? Isn't that a great democratic, inspiring kind of act?
I very much agree conceptually with that. I think it should have been done a long time ago. What I worry about is to say to educators and to students and to parents, with all the information and all the really good things in this act, which I'm a huge fan of, is to say, now go do this, but to not give them the support and information and funding to do the work that needs to be done. That I think it's setting a very high expectation and a really good one that we should all achieve, but it's not fair to set an expectation and then not provide people with the resources.
The problems in the implementation and the funding.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We are a little bit past our midpoint here. We'll continue to talk with listeners and also with our guest, Patty Sullivan. She's director of the Center on Education Policy in Washington, D.C. Before that, she served as deputy director for advocacy and strategic planning at the Council for Chief State School Officers. She also has been on the staff at the National Governors Association. We're talking about education and particularly about this legislation that's been now in effect for a couple of years, No Child Left Behind, talking about what it is and how it has worked and some of the concerns that educators across the country have about it. Questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good. Anywhere that you can hear us, it's 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Indiana and on line number 3. Hello.
Hello. I'd like for you, if you could, to tease apart the money situation. Since the beginning of the No Child Left Behind, I remember there were criticisms up front that the monies just weren't enough to do the things that the Republicans said they wanted to do. And I was wondering who's being tight-fisted, or is it that they missed estimate, or the states decided that maybe we should try to make a move here to get more money using different ways to do that? I just sort of like, who's the culprit here, if there is one? And perhaps even something about the legislative history of the thing as far as that goes. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
The funding question is a good one to ask, but a complicated one to answer. And in this case, there are what some would say multiple culprits. First of all, when the Congress enacted the No Child Left Behind Act, the Congress, in its complicated method of allocating money, sets a benchmark of how much money they think it's going to cost to implement the law. And that's referred to as an authorization level. Then they actually open their checkbook and write a check, but they don't always write the check for the amount that they think it's going to cost. And so the gap between what Congress provides in terms of funding and what it actually costs is what's causing problems across the country and has led to the lawsuits that I referred to earlier. And the gap there is, the gap in each state is different because each state left the No Child Left Behind sort of starting gate in a different place. And so what it costs each state to implement it is different. So you have to look in Indiana. In Indiana, there was actually a cost study that was done by the state legislature that looks at what Indiana already has in place in terms of its reforms, accountability system in the state, and what it would cost to implement, and that's available through the state legislature. In addition to the work that the federal government does in terms of not completely meeting its funding commitments, there's always a tension at the state level about funding for education. We watch it across the country. It plays out both within state legislatures and their debate around funding. We have a number of states, at this point more than half of the states, have lawsuits pending around the equity of funding or adequacy of funding in education. Is there truly sufficient funding to meet the goals of what the state has set forth for all students? So you have sort of a federal culprit who's not meeting their terms. You've got a state culprit in the sense that they're not fully funding what it takes to implement their work. And then finally, at the district level, there's often tensions. We talked earlier with a caller who referred to a referendum that was just enacted around school construction. Most of the facilities across the country are very dated. We've got issues around teacher salaries. I mean, there are lots of issues at the district level that need to be addressed, and most communities are just not supportive necessarily of their school district. So we often see referendums go down. The question is, given that No Child Left Behind is just a part of our obligation as a country to educate students, you know, who is really responsible for all this? And the answer is sort of everybody is. We have to make a commitment on the part of the country to fund these programs and to make sure that students get what they need, and we're not doing that yet.
All right. I hope that that gets at the questions of the call. Let's continue. Line number one, someone here in Urbana. Hello.
Well, I would just make a accusation and have you respond, and that is that, and I'll hang up, and that is that you keep talking about the lack of funding, but so-called extra work that you should have been, that you're complaining about, in a lot of ways should have been done all along. In a lot of ways, our schools are built around notions of social status and social conformity, and very often quote good school unquote just means socially and economically advancing to a certain segment of the kids. And I think what you're really complaining about is that the painful shift of the limited resources from this huge throwing it at that small portion of the high status kids, so a painful shift from those high status kids to the low status kids, and it's going to stay that way until there are more minority administrators and faculty, and I just want to hear you respond to that accusation. I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, there's a fair bit of research, which we probably didn't even need to do, but we did, that shows that one of the strongest academic indicators of how a child is going to do academically is based on socioeconomic status, the academic credentials of their mother. I mean, there's all sorts of work that shows that kids do better if they come from more affluent families. And you're right in the sense that the way most local school funding formulas work is that it's done by, you know, where you live. and it's done by property taxes, and it's formulas that are allocated through the state legislature that tend to honor or subsidize higher income neighborhoods. But indeed, that's why the federal government comes into play, because the federal government provides a subsidy for low-income families, and the Title I program is purely done on poverty and concentration of poverty. So there's some attempt here to balance that. But I don't disagree with you in that, you know, certainly students who are more affluent and who have the opportunity and experiences that those kids have growing up are probably going to perform better. But it's why we, within No Child Left Behind, are really now focusing on, even within suburban, very high-performing suburban school districts, to now focus on those kids who don't have those benefits. So I'm not sure which state the caller is from, but I suspect that even within the Chicago, very high-end performing Chicago school districts, the suburban school districts, now if you look at their data and you break it down, you'll see that there are some kids who don't come from the most affluent families who are now getting more attention, because the law is now reporting on ways, in ways that it did not before. So there are good things about this, and the reporting will drive the allocation of funding. So we'll see a little bit of a shift, not as much as I think the caller would like to see, but a little bit of shift in those resources.
Well, you touch on something that I think is certainly a very important issue. It's a little different than that we have discussed, but it's certainly connected, and that is the issue of equity or inequity. When you look at the resources that individual districts have to put behind their students, that wealthy districts have a base of wealth to draw on. They can spend more on their students. Poorer districts have less. Now, the state is supposed to try to in some way equalize that. But here, for example, in the state of Illinois, between the district that has putting the most money behind its students and the district that's on the other end, there's an enormous difference. The spread is huge. And the state may be able to do a little something about that, but not too much. And as you say, a lot of places around the country in individual states, they're arguing about this. And particularly the poorer districts are crying out and saying, we don't have the resources, and that just isn't fair. Is that, do you think, something that we might see in more places, a significant effort on the state level to address this whole issue of inequity in funding?
Well, certainly the No Child Left Behind Act puts out two very strong standards, which will feed into the equity debates that are going to go on in states. One is that you have to lay out very, very clear standards that all kids have to meet. And two, you have to report on how they're doing. And so within each state debate now, there is no question as to what is expected for the students to do. And so around that, though, will become a debate around what it takes to get the kids to meet the standard. Within the industry, it's referred to as the opportunity to learn costs. What does it cost to get the kids to proficient or to meet the standard? And so that debate will go on, but it will go on with a very different set of parameters because of the law. But we'll continue, and I suspect, as we have seen historically, we'll continue to see states reacting very differently. I mean, some states continue to rely on local property taxes. Some states have shifted and provide tremendous state subsidies. Some states have gone to a lottery, using their lottery funds. I mean, there are a lot of different mechanisms by which states have tried to drive money into education. But I think the debate will probably become more intense, but will also become a little bit more clear because of the federal act.
We have about 15 minutes left. I have another caller we'll get right to. And again, let me introduce the guest, Patty Sullivan. She's director of the Center on Education Policy in Washington, D.C. And we're talking here this morning primarily about the legislation known as No Child Left Behind. This is something that the center has been tracking now through all of its existence. And in fact, a couple of months ago, back in March, did a comprehensive national survey of how students were doing as measured by tests. And if you're interested in, you have have access to the Internet, you can go to the website of the Center on Education Policy, and you can see this and a lot of other information, publications, reports, and so forth that they have done on various kinds of education issues. The questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go again to another caller. This is someone listening in Champaign, and line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that NCLB kind of combines a well-intentioned desire to bring some of our underperforming children along. It combines that with this suspicion that somehow the schools aren't doing the job, and if these kids don't get educated, then it must be their fault, whether it's the teachers, and I think there's kind of an underlying current of negativism towards the teachers, which came out in the previous call, which kind of shocked me from that specific person. But in any event, what I wanted to talk about was what looks like a statistical impossibility. Isn't embedded in NCLB the assumption that somehow all the kids can perform at the same level?
You have a good point, and one that is very much a debate within policy circles. And I apologize in advance for doing this, but it's very difficult to talk about this piece of legislation without getting into the weeds a little bit because it's complicated. No Child Left Behind sets the standard for all kids to reach proficient, and it sets that standard because it was done very much in a political context. There was just no way that the Congress was going to say these 5 kids should be left behind or these 10 kids should be left behind. So they set the standard saying that no child should be left behind and pushed very hard to get all kids into the accountability system. However, within the law itself, there are different provisions that provide exemptions for students who are not going to be able to make the standard. There is a debate raging a little bit right now about who those students are. It's very, very clear that students with the most severe disabilities will not be able to meet the proficiency standards, and so they are automatically exempted, or 1% of those students in every state is exempted. There is now something that's just being put on the books, another set of exemptions for students who have mild disabilities. And this is an area where there is much debate because there is at least the accusation, I don't buy into it myself, but some would say, that too many educators pushed lower-performing students, students of color, students of high poverty, into the special ed category when they didn't belong there. And so there's a question about trying to make sure that students that are sort of in between the most severely handicapped or disabled students and those who are not and who are in the general ed program, which of those students shouldn't be there and which of them do we really need to just catch them up, teach them to read, really get them back on track. And so that group of students right now is being debated about who should be in that group and who shouldn't within each state system. In addition, there are some exemptions for students who don't speak English. We have a tremendous number of students who enter this country every year, even at the high school level, who have never been in school before and are not fluent in the language, and it takes time to learn the language, to learn to read and write, and to be able to be assessed and counted under the system. So those students need some extra support and some extra time. The U.S. Department of Education has just granted additional flexibility there. But to the extent that we are still sorting it out for English language learning students, we very much are. So while on paper it makes it sound like every student has to reach, you know, proficiency in 2014, we are working to make sure that those students who aren't able to get there are treated appropriately under the system, but at the same time challenging those who might make it who under the current system wouldn't.
But even if you subtracted from the pool of students, the 3 groups that you mentioned, and looked at the rest of them, I mean, have we kind of forgotten the bell curve? You know, we all grew up with the bell curve where some kids are really smart and some kids are really dumb. I mean, let's just tell it like it is. And everybody else is in between those 2 groups. Have we now said that everybody can crowd into one end of the bell curve and everything will be just fine?
Well, we basically have sort of thrown the bell curve out here. We're testing individual students. We're not grouping students into categories of how they're going to perform. We also, in many states, have set the bar fairly low. I mean, in most, for example, in most high school or most states who have high school exit exams, we're assuming that when you graduate from high school, you are operating at an eighth or a ninth grade level. And that's what educators and state officials have decided is appropriate. So to the extent that you can get everybody to a certain level, you can get there. The question is, how high is the level, and how do you get everybody to it?
Yes. Okay, I'll get off the horn and let somebody else talk. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We have, about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. 333-9455 is our telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Let's go to some other callers here. We'll go to someone in Crystal Lake on our line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. I think what you're saying, that we really have to segregate the groups in their ratings, because people with a different socioeconomic backgrounds do not do as well. And to ameliorate that, we got to see that there are jobs for the teenagers and unemployed families that really can't give their kids any idea that they need an education very well. They don't know that they need it themselves. In one degree, we should at least have a state income tax to help out somewhat and equalize funding, because even in the past, when federal grants have been given, schools improve, they had federal grants for radio programs and things like that, and poorer schools had much more difficulty getting those things. But I think we should have a state income tax to equalize the funding that all schools get. But likewise, their socioeconomic background has to improve to make kids understand why they need an education. And, you know, those things are important. And the other thing is, I think you're saying we should, like foreign students, like Latin Americans, they come maybe from a farm background, they're not going to see the need for higher education, even if the society changes in the needs and our jobs, and you can't really get them to see the same as people that grow up in the, you know, this sort of professional backgrounds. And special ed kids should not be included in what the score is on the general level. But different groups should be in separate categories to see if they improve. And you can't really improve some kids that don't have a mental background. That some that are very smart and lazy, you can improve theirs, perhaps.
Yeah, the caller certainly raises a number of questions, good questions, and the basic school funding question is among them, and that's, in a sense, that's another program, I suppose. One thing maybe I would ask you, Ms. Sullivan, have there been places, states, where they have decided to radically change the funding base for schools and move away from the property tax and go to more reliance on an income tax?
I confess, I'm not an expert in school finance, and you're right. This is a whole other topic for another program. There are a real mix of methods that states have taken on the school finance question. Some states have chosen to sort of subsidize the property tax to cap the amount at the local level, how much a local can spend, how high the taxes can come. Some states have chosen to put an influx of state money, you know, almost to the point where 90% of the funding for the programs come from the state. All of these methodologies have strengths and weaknesses. We're watching in some states, I think all of us at some level watched a little bit in the education policy world, the troubles that the state of Oregon went through. Oregon provides at the state level almost 90% of the funding. But they were funding their schools through state government using the state funding, and then the state ran into serious financial trouble, as most states did. And we all read in Doonesbury about the fact that schools in the state of Oregon had to close in April because they ran out of money. So, you know, there are different methods, different strategies, whether it's state, whether it's local, whether you do a combination of state and local and caps on property taxes. We haven't completely worked out this formula. But certainly we've got a lot of states in court and a lot of people spending a lot of time trying to figure this out. I think the bottom line, and the caller raises this, is that we need to figure it out, because to the extent that we're creating expectations for schools and for students and for families, and sort of more broadly as a country, we need a good educational system, and we need to figure out how to fund it.
We're at the point, I'm sorry to say, we're going to have to stop. We have another caller we can't take, and I'm sure we'll get back to this subject other days in other ways. Maybe just very, very quickly, again, to go back to the report that your organization did at the beginning, finding that of the states and districts that you surveyed, most of the states and most of the districts say that student achievement on state tests is improving. At the same time, they also say in some of the districts that really need a lot of help, they say they don't have the resources to try to get those kids up to that same level. Can we really say that No Child Left Behind is really responsible for the improvement? Is it the fact that the federal government said to the states so strongly, you need to improve performance and we need to see it? I mean, how much of it really can you trace to NCLB?
My answer to that question is very simple. If states and districts had not done anything on education reform until the day before No Child Left Behind had been implemented, I would probably say No Child Left Behind had a lot more impact. But No Child Left Behind came along after 20 years of district and state-level reforms, led by a series of governors, many of whom, you know, then went to the White House. Bill Clinton is a good example. George Bush is a good example, who brought their reforms and their experiences from their states to the federal government and to the nation. And so it's very difficult to discern what has caused what here. No Child Left Behind has given us new focus and new impetus, and that's a good thing. And it's not going to go away, and we think that's a good thing because it's provided a lot of opportunity for students and a lot of opportunities for families that they didn't have before, and so we're supportive of that. But indeed, you can't attribute one set of activities purely to the law, and the law needs to be tweaked a little bit because it's not working as well as it should be. And so in the end, is it a good thing? Yes. But can we give it credit for increased student performance? I don't think so.
Well, I want to say thank you very much, Ms. Sullivan, for giving us your time today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Our guest, Patty Sullivan, Director of the Center on Education Policy in Washington, D.C. And again, if you're interested in finding out more about the center, reading some of the studies that they have done on education and educational policy, they do have a website, and it's very easy to find. Just type Center on Education Policy in your web browser, and you'll come up with it. Focus 580, our program is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. In the next hour, we will have as our guest David Kennedy. He's professor of law at Harvard University, and we'll talk about international humanitarianism, the benefits, but perhaps more importantly, the costs. He's written about this in his book, The Dark Sides of Virtue, Reassessing International Humanitarianism. That's in the next hour. First, though, we'll have news from National Public Radio, and before that, an update on the markets.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents